It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Pretty simple. I saw a number today, eye-popping. The number $312 billion. That is the amount that the top 25 richest families in this country have seen their wealth increase over the last 12 months. That's an annual gain of 22%. They've seen a nice little bit of change thanks to the pandemic. Disaster capitalism never doing better. And it's one of these things that I got to tell you, it's angering and it's frustrating when you hear the front groups that they fund saying, you know, we can't do anything. We cannot possibly build better roads, bridges. We can't possibly invest in the future. We can't help kids get a start at the beginning of their academic career with universal pre-K. Can't help them get college educated. We can't do any of this stuff. Sorry. Can't do it because we're broke. And we have a political party and a half, or maybe not a whole half, a political party solely, and then a couple still left on the other side who are saying, no, we can't really raise taxes on the wealthy because they're the job creators. Even we know that that's not reality. And what's really frustrating to me is I look at that $312 billion number just in 12 months. That's what they've increased their wealth in just the last year. That's not the nearly $2 trillion that our billionaire class has put into their pocket. That's just the top 25. That's a reasonable size bus. And you go, but Rick, they're the captains of industry. Without them, we would all be standing around looking at each other. Is that so? And what do these folks do? What do they do with their fortunes? They could be building legacies. They could be solving problems. They could make this truly the greatest place on earth. But no, we have to put up with them shooting phallic rockets into the sky and then thanking us for paying for it. We get to see their obsesses. We get to see their insane lifestyles while the rest of the folks here are struggling to put food on the table, worried about their children. Are they going to get sick in school? Being forced back into workplaces that could be dangerous. But you know what they do with their money better than anyone else? They fund euphemistically named front groups that their sole purpose is to divide and conquer we the people. You know, they're spending tons of money on what is right now a well-coordinated attack because they're starting to see that working people have had enough of it. They're starting to see the rumblings of working people who are overworked, underpaid, undervalued, mistreated. And there's no way that they can get them back with the old tools. So what they're doing is they're going back to the good old days of divide and conquer. We got to give people something else to be angry about. Because here's the thing, we're in the middle of what's being dubbed as the great resignation because people are tired of being mistreated at work. And there's another ghosting is now something new where someone will take a job and they don't show up because maybe they found a better job or maybe they just had a bad feeling about the one that they took and said, you know what, I changed my mind. Either way, not good signs for our employment class who have been used to desperate, pliable, obedient workers, people who are hungry enough to come to work in crummy conditions for poverty wages and not question too much of it. Just happy to, you know, just happy to have a job. And people are finally, you know, having enough of it. And the thing that gets me is instead of creating better jobs, instead of doing what we were told, remember back in Econ 101? Remember how we were told, you know, when we were learning about rice and beans and you know, all of that stuff? Remember how they told us that, you know, if things got bad and the free market, the invisible hand, would adjust and things would get better because employers would have to offer more money and better wages and conditions and things would have to get better if they wanted to attract talent? Well, they're not doing that. Because, again, they've conned us into believing, or some of us, those old narratives. But what they've done is they've spent the money that they've gotten, like I said, buying a political party and a half or a political party and a handful. They're buying media everywhere and literally laughing all the way to the bank. $312 billion in the last 12 months that our 25 top families have put into their account. Now, you look at this. How have they divided us? Well, the old ways. You know, race, gender, sexual orientation. Those have always been the biggies, right? You give somebody something else to look at while they're picking our pockets. And now with so many different ways to attack on those fronts, slicing and dicing and pitting us against each other, let the games begin. And our billionaire-funded, euphemistically named front groups are in full spin mode. Every day my email box is full with one group or another, with their little particular angle, whether it's race, gender, sexual identity, you know, Martians, whatever. Whatever their angle is to get into that right-wing pot of cash, that's where they go. You know, today's was, you know, the soft bigotry of Democrats voting reforms. And I loved that one because I'm going, wait a second. I saw what you did there. You kind of turned that around. Their argument is by making it easier for minorities to vote, you're basically calling them stupids because they can't go over all the hurdles and obstacles that have been put in their way to vote. And it's your fault that you're pointing this out because they should be able to go over these hurdles that other people don't have to go over. So it's soft bigotry pointing out that it's an unequal system. It's brilliant. It's brilliant messaging. And I read it. I read it twice because this is what they do so masterfully. My other favorite today was the underlying racism of infrastructure improvements. Yes, by improving inner cities transportation networks, by creating jobs and you know, refitting our buildings, retro engineering our buildings and all of that, somehow that this is somehow racist. And I couldn't find it in there, but they had to throw it in there, the racism of infrastructure. And, you know, of course, you get the ones from the school choice people who, you know, are you handing your children over to fill in the blank? You know, whatever boogeyman they want to throw in there, that was there today, too. And really all it's meant to do is keep us pitted against each other, divided and angry at each other, which we're good at being. And then they hit with the main point. Slide it in a little bit, because the one thing they all agree on, regardless of which angle they take, whether it's the homophobia or the misogyny or the racism, or no matter how they came to the dance, they all leave with the same woman or the same man, which is it's the economy. They want workers to have rights. And this is where I go back to what my original thoughts have always been. You know, as someone who grew up in a minority in a minority community, I learned very young that black and white didn't matter as much as green. Because no matter what the color of our skin was, we were all broke. And if we ever decided that we were going to come together and demand that we all got better off, our 25 families who pocketed $312 billion extra dollars on top of what they own, the billions they already had, they wouldn't be sitting on that kind of money. And that would be more equally distributed. You wouldn't have the hunger. You wouldn't have the pain, the misery, the suffering, the struggle that we have for a good majority of our country. Even people who think they're doing okay are still on the treadmill trying not to fall off, hoping that one illness, one accident, one unfortunate circumstance doesn't throw them in the chaos. And this pandemic really has highlighted the fact that so many of us are one, two paychecks away from disaster. And a lot of folks, you know, because of the moratorium, they were falling behind all along. And you see these rich people, our billionaire class, our captains and titans of industry, you see them, you know, funding away. And it brings me back to something my grandfather always said. You know, if you're going to see a rich guy pull a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. If they're spending this kind of coordinated money fighting against Biden's Build Back Better plan, which, again, I think could be better, but it's good. It's a start. It's a push. It's historic. It's, in my view, almost a reset of a lot of the last 40 years conservative attacks, which is why the billionaire class not happy about it. The billionaire class has been spending money for 40, 50 years to get to this point. This is where they want to be. They've got both hands placed firmly on the steering wheel, and they are driving this car right into the ditch where they want it to be, because they know even after they wreck the car, they're still going to get the insurance money. They're still going to be better off because they've set up a system where heads they win, tails we lose. No matter how it is, they have figured out how to play this game in such a way that, you know what? They're insulated. And it got me thinking today. You know, I was having a conversation with a friend today, and, you know, we were talking about, you know, how we got to this moment, how we've been so easily separated. And, you know, I said, look, you know, my view on it is, you know, you go back to my grandparents' generation, the greatest generation. You know, they fought fascism overseas, and they came home and remained united in the workplace to fight the same kind of tyrannical behavior that you would have seen overseas here at home. And they fought for what was the most prosperous working class in history, because they understood at the end of the day, while they had many divisions, and they did, a lot of the same ones, and even more deeply ingrained, it was still about wages, hours, conditions. It was still about the jobs. It was still about holding those billionaires in check. It was the militancy of that generation. And the thing is, I used to say, you know, they're not the greatest generation. They just rose to the challenges of the time. They didn't have a choice. They were in a corner. They were backed into the corner. You don't have any choices when you're backed into a corner. You got to fight your way out. But you look at right now, are we rising to the challenges of our time with, you know, child hunger, just crazy? We've got homeless veterans. We've got a tsunami of people about to be thrown out of their homes. We've got millions of people without jobs. Wages are rising a bit, but nowhere near where they should be. And when people have the audacity to stand up, step forward and speak out about, hey, we want better, immediately what happens? Well, you look at what happened at Amazon down in Bessemer, Alabama. They brought in the police that they paid off to harass people. They figured out how to get the U.S. Postal Service to bring in a special mailbox that they could monitor. They plastered union hate mail all over the bathroom stalls. They paid people to walk around with sandwich boards on their bodies saying how bad the union is and how vote no and you can do it without dues and all of this nonsense. All the while they knew how the vote was going to turn out, because they were harassing and intimidating people, because they have the power and the money and the resource to do it. So when there's a spark of people going, hey, maybe this isn't right. Maybe we should be speaking out against this. Maybe we should say enough is enough. Maybe we should have a great resignation. Maybe we should be ghosting these crummy employers and make them better. Well, they pull out the old bag of tricks. Anything that's going to move us forward, anything that's going to be get done for we the people, especially we the working people, has to be crushed and with extreme prejudice. Because that's all they really know, isn't it? And it doesn't matter what the issue is. It's about their winning and, of course, our losing. All under the guise that we're told that if we give them all the money, we cut the taxes, we cut the regulations, we do all this stuff to help them, that they're eventually going to take care of us. They're going to be benevolent, like good dictators. Now, a lot of us, we like to believe, no, we're smarter than that. We're a democratic society. But when you look at the polling on a lot of the things in the Build Back Better plan, rural access to, you know, decent internet, good roads, bridges, couple extra years of schooling for kids to get an associate's degree through a community college. These are polling really popular. The jobs that would come out of massive investment in infrastructure, the jobs that would come out of moving towards a cleaner, greener economy. Popular as can be, and that's why they don't happen. Because they're popular with we, the working people, not the billionaires who are stuck in the entrenched interests. They're the folks who are making profit off of the old economy, the exploitive economy. And I'm looking at this moment right now. I'm looking at the moment that we have. If you can get a handful of Democratic senators in line, that we can make historic changes for our kids. We can make historic changes for the future of this country. There's opportunity here. And yet the moneyed interests, they're doing everything in their power to divide us. And the sad thing is, they're winning. It's working. Because there's so much going into their messaging. And they've been in full spin mode for a while now. But it always comes back to the working people. Because in every one of those things, those emails I got today, the thing that they finished up on was, you know, they're going to pass something called the PRO Act. And the PRO Act is either racist or misogynist or whatever. Because, well, the ABC test. We've taken women from exploitive employment jobs and we've put them into exploitive you're on your own jobs and called them their own boss. And by saying, no, we want you to get better wages, hours, conditions, somehow that's misogynistic. As my grandfather always said, if they were going to make something better for you, do you think they'd really let you do it? And the answer is no. So for me, anytime I see these, I immediately recoil. And I think that's the reaction for most folks. I'm going to take a quick break here. When we come back and talk a little bit about people who have had enough. Quick break, right back after this. Nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2011. That was the day hundreds of ILWU strikers blocked railroad tracks near Longview, Washington. They hoped to stop grain shipments from moving in and out of the EGT grain terminal. Longshoremen had been sitting down on the tracks throughout the summer, resulting in over 100 arrests. No trains had moved in or out of the terminal since July. But then a federal judge issued an injunction against ILWU pickets. The BNSF Railroad tried to move grain once again. ILWU picketers in Vancouver were able to hold off the train until police forcibly dispersed the crowd. Then hundreds gathered at Longview to block the train from coming in. That's when police went on the offensive. They used clubs and pepper spray against the longshoremen, arresting 19. They threw ILWU President Bob McElrath to the ground. Rumors spread that police had broken his arm. Hundreds of regional longshoremen rushed to Longview. The Seattle and Tacoma ports shut down in protest. The next morning, 10,000 tons of grain were opened onto the railroad tracks. The grain export terminal was the first to be built in the Pacific Northwest in almost 30 years. EGT hoped to undercut the powerful ILWU, who controlled operations at the port since its founding in the 1930s. The union refused to agree to work 12-hour shifts at straight time. The EGT hoped to break the hiring hall by refusing to recognize maintenance and inside workers at the terminal. They then attempted to fill jobs with workers from the operating engineers. But the ILWU persevered. By the end of January, EGT had backed off many of its demands, negotiations resumed, and days later, the contract was signed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So So we've heard stories all across the country of healthcare workers being underpaid, overworked, mistreated, all under the guise of, well, you know, there are frontline heroes. There are essential workers. Yeah, they're all of those things. And in many places, we're hearing stories of workers saying, you know what? Had enough. Enough is enough. That's it. And that's what workers at the University of Chicago Medical Center's Ingalls Memorial Hospital have said. Enough. In fact, they said, we want better treatment. We want better conditions, wages, all of those things. And, you know, here's the thing. They won one election, and then, well, they had to go back and do it again. So if it's not hard enough to win once, you got to do it twice. Still not getting the respect that they deserve from the University of Chicago Medical Center there at Ingalls. And here to share some thoughts on, well, why, how we got to this point, why this is the way it is. I've asked DeLucy LaVea to come talk with us. She's SEIU, HC, Indiana, Illinois Union organizer. She's one of the lead folks on this campaign. DeLucy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, no, thank you, Rick. We really appreciate the platform and, you know, the conversation that's going to happen today about this fight over at Ingalls. So what do you want to know? I can tell you it all.
So walk me through how this whole thing started. I read somewhere that you guys ran a campaign a year or so back during the past administration. Something came up. You won the election. They set it aside. You've run it again. And now you're in this spot. Get me to this point.
Yeah, no, for sure. So basically, workers over at Ingalls Hospital have been trying to unionize for over 20 years. And until recently, 2 years ago, pre-pandemic, it was really just the organizing efforts that pushed the election through a first time. It was a heavy anti-union, union busters being used because the hospital has a resource to do that. They claimed that the first election, the NLRB did a mistake with the envelope. So they said it wasn't a valid victory for the union, although the election was won. So we had two options, and that was under the Trump board was either rerun that election or, fight it in the court. And we decided to rerun it again. And workers, but the bullet, they ran the election again and they won their union twice. Fast forward to now being at the bargaining table. We've been at the table since late March of this year. And every step of the way, it's just been a struggle. Nurses had actually organized a couple of months before the election was won through SEIU with a different union. And Ingalls is part of a larger health system, the University of Chicago. You just mentioned that earlier. And they have a union representation over at that campus in Hyde Park with Teamster 743 and NNU for the nurses. And really, we wanted to go to the bargaining table and to uphold that standard that's been fought for at this other campus because they're within the same system, although the management at the bargaining table is claiming that they are not. And really mirror those standards to our hospital workers that we represent over at Ingalls because they shouldn't be held to a different standard. They're doing the same work. They're delivering the same patient care. But management hasn't, done that. And that's kind of where we're at right now at the bargaining table. And honestly, we were going to have a member today to share her story. We were having a little bit of technical difficulties. Right. But wanted to share with you a little bit of our demographic and like the makeup of our membership, because I think that speaks volumes to why we are where we're at in our fight right now.
No, and we're going to bring in Lolita Washington. She's a 29-year employee at Ingalls Memorial Hospital there. Lolita, do I have you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here. Steve.
I appreciate you taking a little time for us. Share with me this story. Why are you involved in this? What made you guys, you and your coworkers, decide that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, why did I get involved? I got involved because there was a lot of issues going on at Ingalls. We need better health and safety, better wages, better benefits, equal pay, and it's a lot of disrespect.
Right, and all in this time frame.
It's a lot of unfairness going around, and we're just trying to make a change.
Right, and all in a time when you're supposed to be the You're supposed to be the essential workers, the frontline heroes. You're put in this position. As I was listening to the organizer talk about the fact that nurses just, you know, right around the corner there are making wages that are higher, to me that's a major sign of disrespect. And I was looking at their website, and their explanation is, well, you know, those are downtown people. You folks out here, you're not worth that. That's kind of what I took from that.
Yeah, and that's where we're getting from that, because we all are very good workers, and we're here because we care about our patients. We do a good job. All of us, the co-workers, we all like family, and we feel like we're there, we're doing the job, we're taking care of the patients. We feel like we need to be worth taking care of the patients. They need to show us our worth. We're not getting that.
Right.
They're not showing us what we're worth. We're there during the time. We've been there during the whole pandemic, faithfully, and they don't want to pay us.
Now this
they don't want to pay us anything.
This is a company that, you know, as I understand, they're not poor, yet they keep crying poverty. And I do want to bring your organizer, DeLuce, back in here to get some thoughts on this, because, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about, you know, this company and just how wealthy they are. This is not a poor company.
No, it's not.
It's not a
they're
poor
very
company
rich
at all. Actually, and I actually can hear Lolita, but I want to give you some figures. Is that okay?
Please do.
All right. So they're actually a billion-dollar health system. UCMC is worth $4.1 billion, including more than $500 million in cash and $1.2 billion in investments. And they actually received more than $400 million in federal COVID-19 support and came out profitable in that year of 2020 of the pandemic with a total profit of $75.5 million.
Wow. So this is not a poor company. And yet one of the things that they're trying to cry is poverty, because I was looking at their website, you know, and trying to justify why they weren't paying wages on the same level as the other hospitals and, you know, a whole bunch of the same kind of union busting tactics. So it appears to me from the outside that this is a company that has the resources to pay union busters to build websites and to do the union busting stuff. But they're not willing to pay the wages to keep their employees happy. Seems weird to me.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, I think one of the direct relations is that they continue to say that Harvey is in a suburb that opted out of the minimum wage of the $15. And because elected officials opted out, Ingalls doesn't feel responsible to that responsibility of paying folks a livable wage. Instead, they pay poverty wages. We refer to it as a Harvey discount in our campaign, actually. And, you know, this is affecting 365 of their staff, which are union members across a number of different job classifications, including certified nursing assistants, behavioral health techs, phlebotomists, unit secretaries. So it's folks that really are the ones operating that hospital and delivering direct patient care.
Lolita, I want to go back to you for a second, because,
yeah,
you know, when you hear the kind of wealth that this company has, the kind of money that they're throwing around, and then denying you just a basic, what should be a basic living wage, what does that make you feel? What does it make your coworkers think?
It makes us very disappointed. It's like a slap in the face to know that a job that you've been on, you've been very committed. We're very good at what we do, lest we wouldn't be there. We're very caring employees, and we take pride in what we do. And it's just very sad that your management feels like we're not worth getting a raise. We're not worth the pandemic pay. We're just not worth anything. But they're all making six figures. It's just totally a disappointment. To me, it's a total disrespect.
Now, you've been an employee there for 29 years?
Yes, I have.
And in that 29 years, has the treatment always been like this, or is this something relatively new? Because, you know, I've talked to nurses across the country. As you see consolidation happen, as you see bigger hospital systems taking over, you become much more of just a number and not an actual person. And the conditions, you know, they start treating you like machinery. Is that your experience here?
That's the experience now. It wasn't always like that. We were always a close-knit family. You can talk to the supervisors. You didn't have this problem. But now, like you say, it's all about the money, the body, and that's it.
Yeah. So in this moment,
the money, the numbers, and the body, that's it.
Right. So in this moment, as you guys are going through this process for a second time, it's hard enough in this country to win an NLRB election one time, but you guys have had to do it now twice. So that this shows me that you guys have the resolve to push forward with this. So what's the message to the University of Chicago Medical Center, who own this Ingalls Memorial Hospital? What's the message to them from you and your coworkers?
The message is we're tired. And we're not giving up until we win this fight. We are in it to win it, and we are not giving up.
And that
it's time for a change.
Ultimately, that I hope is the message that they hear out of this. Let me go back to Dulce here for a second, because you know that's the kind of message I've been hearing across the country. Is, you know, people have had, you know, had enough. They're ready to take this on. What's the message for the hospital then in this moment? Because I understand you guys are getting further down the road. What's the message here?
Message is loud and clear. We have a set of priorities. One is that we want to see raises reflective to UCMC's profits that do not leave anyone behind, but raise the floor for everyone to a minimum of 15 to make sure that they don't forget about their most loyal and senior folks and actually bring them to a rate that's worth what the work they do, because at the end of the day, they've been there for 20 plus years. I mean, Lolita's not alone in this story. You have folks that have been there for 20, 25, 30, 40 plus years, make sure that, you know, they do everything in regards to be able to keep them safe, because wages is directly connected. Staffing is directly connected to wages. When you cannot attract employees and retain them, it's a revolving door. And the most affected are the patients and the folks that stick around because they have that loyalty to the organization. But ultimately, I think that our priority here is to make sure that overall we win dignity and respect through all of these priorities, and that they actually put something in the contract that says, look, we're committed to respecting and providing dignity to all of our employees. And I think that's what our win would look like. And the message to the hospitals that our members have spoken, and they're ready to take action and willing to do whatever it takes to get through that finish line, because they've been at it for a long time, and now is not the moment to back down. It's in the contrary. It's a moment in time to take action and send a clear message to management through our collective power and our strength in numbers.
Yeah, it's in this moment that especially now that, you know, you've got people who have really had enough of the bad conditions, and I've heard horror stories, especially in our healthcare industry, where a lot of people are leaving because of the stress, the pandemic is taxing people, and then to have an employer who's basically trying to shortchange you at every opportunity, given the fact that they've taken a bunch of government money to help make sure that that people have the ability to pay decent wages, and we keep hearing about these shortages. Don't you want to retain people by paying them the best wage that you can get them, especially considering you're a multi-billion-dollar company? It just seems like a power trip more than it's an economic trip.
Yeah. And can I add something? It's not even about the money, because they have it. It's about the power, right? They want to make sure that they keep that power ultimately. And at the end of the day, they just need to stop running this place like if it was a business. Like, they're actually treating human lives, and they need to put value into that. So we're just asking UCMC to do the right thing and to be the leaders in this, as they claim that they want to be. So Yeah.
Now, where do you see this going here? Real quick, we got another minute left because I want people to help. I want to know how we can help put some pressure where it needs to be, make sure that let them know that the community is behind you, because from what I've seen, you guys have gotten really good community support, which I think is important, especially in a hospital system like the one that you're talking about. So can you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah, so we're back at the bargaining table tomorrow. We ask folks to continue and, to follow our story, because really, I mean, tomorrow we don't know what's going to happen, right? I think that we've shown and sent management a clear message of like, we're all in, but they're unpredictable because they don't care about wasting their money in their tactics, right? So I think continue to follow our story through our social media, SEIU, HCII, Illinois, Indiana, MK, and also, just really look at Harvey. I think that this is the largest employer in the community. We're trying to get local media there. If we can, put some pressure on them through social media and Facebook and just liking our posts when we put them out there, I think tomorrow we'll give an update to through our social media. If people can repost that, right, and tag people within any type of like local organizations that are in there, or like even themselves, like please just do so. We want to start a hashtag of Ingalls Do Better, and that's the one that we've been using. If it can trend, that would be great. Ingalls We're Worth More is another one of our hashtags. So just tag us and make some noise for us, because our members need all the support they can get at the hospital.
Dulce, I appreciate the time. Please keep us up to date on what's going on. Lolita, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Keep up the fight one day longer. Thanks both of you for being here.
No, thank you, Rick.
Again, you look at this, and the reality is you've got these big companies that have such power, such outweighted power. And the fact that they're going to use this divide is just remarkable to me. So I wish them the best. I hope they'll come back and give us some thoughts on where this is going to go going forward. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1903. That was the day that is remembered in Virginia as the wreck of Old 97. Old 97, also known as the Fast Mail, was a Southern Railway freight train. It carried the U.S. mail from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta, Georgia. The train wreck happened on the leg of the trip from Monroe, Virginia to Spencer, North Carolina. The train had come in late to Monroe. It was reported that the railway company ordered the engineer to increase the speed of the train to make up time. The company had to pay a penalty if they delivered the mail late. But when the train neared Danville, Virginia, the tracks curved at the Stillhouse Trestle Bridge. The speed was simply too much. Despite the engineer's efforts to slow the train, it careened off the tracks and plummeted to the rocky ravine 45 feet below. 11 of the 16 people on board the train died, including the conductor, the engineer, and the flagman and both firemen. The railway company blamed the wreck on the deceased engineer. Newspapers across the country carried photos of the wreck. The disaster became the subject of multiple ballads. One version, by Vernon Dalhart in 1924, is thought to be the first million-selling country record in U.S. history. Johnny Cash recorded another well-known version of the song. In 1993, an alternative country band took the name the Old 97s, hearkening back to the disaster and the songs it inspired.
They gave him his orders at Monroe, Virginia. Said, Steve, you're way behind time. This is not 38, this is Old 97. You must put her into Spencer on time.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So President Biden got his COVID-19 vaccine booster today. Got it there at the White House. And he said, look, we know how to beat this pandemic. And it saves lives. We need to get folks to get vaccinated. It seems pretty simple. Pretty simple, according to our president, who went on to say his message was, please go get vaccinated. He goes, please get these shots. It can save your life. It can save the lives of those around you. He said, look, he was first vaccinated back before the inauguration. Now, 6 months, a little over 6 months later, opportunity to get the vaccine. So over 65, 6 months since the last one, he qualified for the booster. But the one thing that he did point out is that the majority of us are doing the right thing. He said that over 77% of adults have gotten at least one of the shots. That means 23% haven't. And he said, look, that distinct minority is causing an awful lot of us an awful lot of damage for the rest of the country. He said this vaccine is of the unvaccinated. That's why I'm moving forward with the vaccination requirements wherever I can. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what does this mean? Are we ever going to get back to life as usual? My next guest has written the piece how COVID-19 has changed Las Vegas and maybe how it's going to change things for the rest of us. That's why I've asked our good friend Helene Olin to come talk with us. Helene is an opinion writer over at the Washington Post. Helene, thanks for taking time for us.
For having me on. And yes, we're coming back to life. And Vegas is back to being Vegas, though with some changes. So I'm of the belief that no one has talked more sense about COVID recently, or really since he's been president, than Joe Biden.
No, and that's, you know, really what we need, you know, someone who's going to, you know, put aside some of the nonsense, all of the craziness that we're hearing from the anti-vax folks, and actually, you know, talk sense. And the sense is, well, get the damn vaccine.
Right. I mean, I would point out, and I've made this point before, I would say both sides have been guilty of some unrealistic talk, though I think on the right, it is much, much worse, right? I mean, on the right, you literally have people who believe that, like, you shouldn't take a vaccine, that a vaccine has chip in it to track you, as my younger son says, what about your iPhone? You know, like, this is craziness, right? But you also have a kind of that is, you know, very scolding of people who are getting vaccinated, who are nonetheless attempting to resume their lives. And I think that's one of the things Biden has been really focused on and really good about is saying, get a vaccine. This will bring us back to normal. This is how we restore normality. This is how we get on with our lives. And because I think that's the important end goal, is everybody wants to resume their lives. And in fact, in many cases, they have resumed their lives. In some places, they never stopped living their lives, right? I mean, because one of the other things that has gone on is the pandemic has really been influenced by what's gone on in the Northeast, which did shut down, and California, which mostly did shut down. So, you know, huge swaths of the country never really shut down at all, right? Like, I spoke to a friend in Utah. I've spoken to people in Utah the entire time. And, like, they're like, yeah, we've just sort of got on with it. Like, so I think that's an important part of the conversation that often gets left out of these discussions.
Yeah, until they get hit with what we're seeing across the South and the Southwest, where they are being hammered. And now we're my hometown of Cleveland right now. They're having some problems where the clinics almost overrun with people.
Right,
who...
but it's a pandemic, as Joe Biden says, it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Right.
If you're vaccinated and you have a breakthrough, which is actually quite rare, right? You're not going to be very sick. The chances are incredible you're not going to get that sick. You're going to have what's called a mild COVID case. And that we're going to have to learn how to live with that. Like, we're not Australia. We're not locking down over this stuff again. I don't think people will lock down. My husband and I went out to dinner the other night, and, you know, it was us, because I live on mostly East Coast time out here in California. So I was out at 5 o'clock at the early bird time. And it was us and a bunch of, like, people in their 60s and 70s who were back out. And we looked at each other and, like, they're not going back in, are they?
No, and you knew we were going to get to this point. You know you're going to get to the point. And it's what it is, you know, it's once you get vaccinated, once you start doing the things right, and then we start doing some real contact tracing and where we have to segregate some things, we do what we should have done a year ago. I'm just kind of throwing that out there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much contact tracing is really going on at this point. If you know of some that I don't, please share.
Yeah, well, I look at some of the stuff that's going on in the schools, and we're doing some of that. I think we lost Helene.
I'm here. I'm back.
Oh, I hate crappy internet. So this is just this is bad.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. It happens. It is what it is. So when you're in Vegas, because part of this was to talk about what's going on in Vegas and how you've seen things change. What did you see?
I saw mobs out on the strip. Slightly disproportionately young, which, market research shows is my eye was correct about that. You have a greater return of younger people than more older people. But, it's pretty crowded. I mean, it's pretty mobbed. What you're not getting back so far in any major numbers are the business travelers. I mean, so you've got a lot of leisure travelers coming in, but you don't have tons of business travelers. Business travel's down about 70% for the year. The conventions seem to be getting somewhere between half and two thirds of their normal people. There are not as many conventions. And this is changing the dynamic of Vegas a bit for a couple of different reasons. Conventioners, people who travel for business tend to spend their money somewhat differently. They tend to be a little bit more extravagant. They're more likely to order room service, right?
Right.
When somebody else is paying your bills, you know how it is, right? The other thing that seems to be going on is the hotels, in part because of these changes in business travelers, have not hired back at the rate you would think, given that hotel occupancy is now at 80%. Normal Vegas occupancy this time of the year is about 90%. Because you would think, they should be hiring back like crazy, and they're kind of not. And one of the reasons I found out is it could trace us back to the business traveler, right? Because leisure travelers tend to, be Thursday through Monday, Sunday, Monday morning. Business travelers tend to be Sunday through Thursday. So hotels are having this kind of gap in the middle of the week. So the result is that they're not hiring back in quite the numbers you would think, given the occupancy numbers.
Right.
The other issue is that they are trying to automate, partly as a response to some labor shortages, but also, do more with less. But that means less jobs, right? So they're trying to push people, to give an example of something I experienced, they're trying to push people to check in online and check out online. I'm not sure how successful they've been at the check-in online because I was on a line of over 100 people when I checked in. And that seems to be a pretty typical experience when I went into Yelp. It seems like most people want to check in person, which makes sense. Like people have all sorts of, I don't know about you, but like when I check in, I'm like, I want this sort of room. I want that sort of room, right? But I certainly checked out online. I admit I did it. Like, it just was easier, actually.
Yeah. Well, most people do. I mean, most people just slide the bill under the door, you leave.
Right.
I checked out.
Right. Right. So you're seeing stuff like that. But the casinos are pretty full at this point. The tables are a little spread further apart than normal. But, I'd say they're almost there. The gambling revenues are, through the roof. Whether that's people coming in and spending more money, some combination of, some online gambling, fill in the blank, right? So, Vegas has, is a return. That being said, unemployment's still really high. Nevada has the highest rate right now in terms of unemployment.
And do we see that coming back? Do we see that ever coming back? Or are these automated changes for permanent? Are some of the things that you see, is this the new normal?
I'm back again. I'm here. Sorry about that. I think the automated changes are going to definitely make an impact, but I do think a lot of the jobs will eventually come back. I mean, you can't automate cocktail waitress on the casino floor.
We can get robots.
You can, but let's come on, like, who's going to sell more drinks? Let's be honest, right?
I wasn't going to go there. But no,
see, so... I'm female. I'm allowed to go there. Okay. Okay. Okay.
I wasn't even going to touch that one with a 10-foot pole. So now what does that mean for the rest of the country? I mean, you knew Sin City was going to come back sooner than anywhere else. Because it attracts a certain kind of consumer, a certain kind of tourist. What's this mean for the rest of the country?
I mean, I think it means good, bad. I mean, good is people clearly want their lives back. I mean, this is becoming a very profound thing, right? Most people, it's been 18 months. Pandemics generally run between 18 and 24 months. So even if, you know, so we're coming towards the end, most likely, hopefully. People are, you know, out and about again. You definitely see it. You know, that being said, of course, there could be another round that, you know, could be, you know, could turn out to be something the vaccine doesn't help with. Yeah. But I think to assume that's going to happen is probably not in anybody's best interest at this point, you know, sort of like be scolding about it is what I mean, right? But on the other hand, you know, I think other cities are still having a pretty hard time of it. You know, places like New York and San Francisco are really having issues because you're not getting, and Washington, are because you still don't have real return of office workers in huge numbers. And the economics are such that, let's say, 90% of those office workers come back by January, but 75% of them come back on a 3-2 schedule. You still have a major economic impact that nobody really wants to acknowledge, because these are cities that are predicated for the most part on people working, huge numbers of people working in, you know, downtown Washington, Capitol Hill, you know, midtown Manhattan, 5 days a week. Telecommuting numbers prior to the pandemic were, you know, 5-7%, you know, 1-2 times a week. I mean, so, you know, to set the sudden mass imposition of what I like to joke about is, you know, casual Friday, but for, you know, remote work, actually could make a huge impact on cities, not in a great way.
Do you see that staying? Do you see the remote work staying stuff? Or do you see at some point we go back to pre-pandemic kind of employment?
I split the difference with everybody on this. I think it will stay. I think for elite workers, you'll see people who can do 4 or 5 days a week away. But I think for the mass of workers, it's going to be more like a casual Friday or a casual Monday, Friday or a casual Tuesday. I mean, fill in the blank what day it's going to be, where people will get a day or two, you know, out of the office. Because I think, I mean, this is politically incorrect to say because nobody wants to admit it right now, but, you know, there are benefits to being in an office. I mean, there's real camaraderie. There's real creativity that's, you know, that's sparked by talking to other people. And the other thing I would point out is that it has always been a very elite phenomenon to be able to work at home 5 days a week through this pandemic, as I don't need to tell you. I mean, the, you know, the Amazon warehouse person is not working remotely. You can't pull something off a warehouse shelf in your house 20 miles away via computer. You can't deliver a package via computer, or if you could deliver it via drone, that means a job that no longer exists. So, you know, this is something that has, you know, in some ways taken on an outsized part in the conversation in terms of how it really is out there.
Going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Last question I was going to throw at you was, you know, something big happened today. Evidently, two Federal Reserve people left, are retiring early, one in Dallas, one in Boston. Any thoughts on this? Yeah, I can't hear you. We'll see how that goes. A little technical difficulty there. Helene, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. I hope folks will take a look at the article, and we'll get that linked out on social media. See how that could work for us. But, you know, I'm looking at this, and I was hoping that Helene would be able to shed some light on why these two Fed leaders had just a little early retirement. Something about maybe they were doing some stock trading while they shouldn't have been, while they were there. I don't know. We're going to get to the bottom of it. But I'm curious your thoughts on how we're going to see a return to employment and all of that. I kind of agree with her in the sense that, that we're going to go back to a workplace that eventually, people have to go back to work. They got to go back to the jobs. I don't see long-term people being able to work from home just because, you know, there's some of that. I like to know where my employees are. I like to control their time. I like to make sure I'm getting maximum benefit, even though some of the productivity stuff that we've seen come out of this has been, from what early indications have been very positive, that people, when they work from home, actually did work. So it was kind of like an experiment. But I think she's right. I think our economy, a lot of it is based on we got to get people into the workspaces. And then all the economic activity that's generated around getting to and from work and, lunches out and all that stuff. It's a lot of stuff. But I think she's right on another front as well, that people want their lives back. And I agree. And this is why I think so many people who have been vaccinated are so frustrated by the 23% of the people around us who aren't. Because, and I think Biden's right on, this is a pandemic right now of the unvaccinated. Because look, I've taken kids to the ball games. We've gone to a couple of concerts this year. It's about getting somewhere back to normal. But every time you look around, you go, is it worth it? Is it worth, because a handful of people are causing chaos for everyone else. Now, look, I understand there are folks who are going to have, issues, and they're probably not people who are going to be in those crowds anyway. They're not the ones who are filling up the stadiums and filling up, Las Vegas. But it would be nice to somehow get past this on the other side. It's a shame we had such difficulty there with Helene. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you have to go back, will you go back? Do you want to go back to the job site? I think I would like to work from home too. I think that would be a good thing. But I also think, like she said, I think there is some camaraderie and stuff there as well. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day the International Lady Garment Workers Union began a strike against the Triangle Shirtwaist Company. Eventually, female workers struck at 339 of the 352 shirtwaist manufacturing firms in New York City. The strike was referred to as the Uprising of 20,000. Women comprised 70% of all garment workers. Men performed the higher paid work of cutting and pressing, while women earned less for assembling and finishing garments. Women often had to furnish their own supplies, including needles, thread, and even sewing machines. Some firms locked the doors to each floor. The workers, mostly young girls and women, had to ask permission to go to the bathroom. While the strike initially started at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, it soon spread to other factories. At a meeting of garment workers in November, a young girl, Clara Lemlich, called for a general strike. One day later, 15,000 shirtwaist workers walked out of the factories, with more joining the strike the following day. The strike continued until February 1910 and ended with factory owners agreeing to meet the demands of the workers, which included better pay and shorter hours. This strike was a notable achievement for these mostly immigrant working women. Nevertheless, garment workers after the 1909 strike continued to suffer harsh working conditions. A year later, many workers died in the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire. The fact that the company locked the doors on each floor meant that the workers had no means of escaping the blaze. Today, it's very difficult to find clothing that is union-made. We must work together to restore labor unions to protect the safety of those who make our clothing, both in the United States and throughout the world. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.